With me now on Fresh Air for a return visit is labor historian Philip Foner, who has just edited a collection of the speeches and writings of the legendary Irish-American labor organizer Mother Jones. She was born in 1830 and became a labor organizer in the early 1890s when she became a paid organizer for the United Mine Workers. She lived until the age of 100 and organized until she was about 93. She traveled from one town to another, inspiring the workers in their fight for safer conditions, higher wages, and a shorter working day. Philip Foner's new book is titled Mother Jones Speaks, published by the Monad Press. Philip Foner's areas of specialization are labor history, Afro-American history, and the history and development of socialism. He's the author of the 7-volume History of the American Labor Movement and of the 2-volume History of Women in the American Labor Movement. Foner recently returned home to Philadelphia from his second trip to China, where he spent 5 months lecturing at 10 different universities on American history and black history. Philip Foner, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Good to be back.
What's the importance of Mother Jones within the American labor movement?
Her importance is how significant a role a woman could play at a time when most historians tended to ignore the role of women in the labor movement. And her significance also is how a courageous person was able to combat conditions for workers, which seemed to be conditions that belonged to the period of the Middle Ages and feudalism rather than to the 20th century, because she sought to bring an end to conditions which were so terrible for the miners and other workers that people didn't believe them when they were revealed to exist. Yet by exposing these conditions and working to end them, she played a very important role in changing American life for the better for millions of people. Also, she played an important role in the fight to end child labor in the United States.
She became an organizer at the age of 60, which is the age that many people retire from organizing or whatever their life's work is. How did she become an organizer?
Well, she was born in Ireland and came to this country as a young child and then was educated and taught. And then she married a labor organizer. And he was in the Molders Union. Her original name was Mary Harris, and then she took the name Jones from her husband, Mary Harris Jones, and then later was called Mother Jones. That was a name applied to a number of very few women who were loved by workers and gave them, as they grew older, the name Mother, and to show their devotion to these people. At any rate, in 1867, she lived in Memphis. Her husband and 4 children died in the yellow fever, and she was just wiped out for a family. And then she went and did work, started a shop, and began to show interest in continuing the work of her husband, worked with the Knights of Labor, railroad workers, and then became a socialist, was a very important figure in the American socialist movement, probably one of the most important women in American socialism. And then in 1890, when the United Mine Workers was organized as a result of a merger between the Knights of Labor Miners Union and another group, she became a paid organizer for the United Mine Workers and went around different parts of the country, including Pennsylvania, which was very important in organizing the miners in Pennsylvania. From that time on, her life was devoted to activity for the labor movement and organizing and for the socialist movement. She didn't always keep her wages. She gave it back to the workers and was very much very important in the big organizing drives of the United Mine Workers.
Recently, a few things have been written about her, and her name has been used as the title for Mother Jones magazine, but she has been a neglected figure for most of the century. To what do you attribute that neglect?
Well, partly because she was so radical and so militant that historians tended to shy away from her. Another reason was that some of the very labor leaders whom she helped to build and in the organization of the unions tended to look upon her as too much of a rank-and-file representative and to push her reputation into the background. But I will say that among the miners, if you go to West Virginia, Pennsylvania, I would say, think, and my own experience has been, that they might have only two books in their homes. One would be the Bible, and the other would be the autobiography of Mother Jones. She was a legend among these workers, and now she's getting to be much better known. But of course, you really can't know Mother Jones until you read her in her own speeches. The autobiography is practically a skeleton of the person. She was herself unhappy with it and felt that it was not, it was ghostwritten, a large part of it. But her speeches, her interviews, her testimony before congressional committees, and over 250 letters that I found of hers, which I've published, those are the things which are really Mother Jones, and they show her to be, in my estimation, not only one of the most remarkable women in American history, but one of the most remarkable women in the history of the world.
Were the documents and letters that you found hard to uncover?
There was no one place where you could get them. You had to go moving around and contacting libraries and historical societies all over the country, even outside the country. For example, Mother Jones was probably the most important figure, certainly one of the two or three most important figures in the United States, to help the Mexican people in their struggle against the terrible tyranny, dictatorship of Porfirio Diaz. She was very much involved in that and helped agents, that is, the revolutionaries who were fighting the Diaz dictatorship, were in great distress in the United States because the American government under Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, because the United States big bankers, Hearst and Morgan and Rockefeller, owed so much of Mexico under Diaz, the government of the United States literally harassed the revolutionaries against Diaz in every possible way. It jailed them, threw them out of the country, deported them to Mexico. And she was very much involved in the fight to stop this, played a very important role in this. And I had to find material in Mexico, which was full of material. She was very much loved in Mexico because of her role. So it was quite a job to find this. But finally, we brought it all together. Well, I was lucky in one respect. For example, in some of her most important speeches during the 1912-1913 coal strike in West Virginia, which she was very much involved in, the police agents and company agents took down her speeches because they wanted to use it to indict her and put her in prison. And so those were later deposited in the archives in the University of West Virginia, which I was able to find. So those are very important. And that way you find out material about people.
If you just
that was before the Freedom of Information Act, I might add.
I'm speaking with Philip Foner, labor historian, who's just edited a new collection of the writings of Mother Jones. It's called Mother Jones Speaks. Well, she was an organizer with the United Mine Workers, and if you say that most or nearly all unions were male at that time, certainly the United Mine Workers was especially so, and the mine is a subterranean world that women just never entered. Then was she welcomed initially when she became an organizer for the mine workers?
Yes, although I must say that it isn't entirely true that all unions were male. After all, the needle trades workers, which were growing up at this time too, most of them were women. And she was active in that, by the way, in helping these women workers organize the International Lady Garment Workers Union, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, etc. In textile, there were a lot of women workers there. She was also helpful in that too. But you're correct, and of course, all the miners were men. The question is, was she welcomed? Yes, she was more than welcome, and there's a good reason for this. I might add, though, I want to make one thing clear. She was the miner's angel, but she worked all over. There wasn't a union in the United States that wasn't having difficulty, that was having difficulty, that didn't call upon her for assistance. And wherever she was, she would go. And she spent endless hours traveling under great difficulties, helping causes outside of the miners, too. So she was a national labor figure, not just the miners, although that was her first love. But as far as the miners are concerned, I would say this. For one thing, she was a person whom they welcomed because she gave them courage. You have to remember what conditions were in the mines at that time, especially in two states where she did so much of her work, West Virginia and Colorado. These mining states were feudal states. That is, the companies dominated the state, the legislature, the courts, and the mines. And miners lived in company towns, in many cases in the back country, far removed from anybody's sight. To get there was a difficult thing. And Mother Jones went there. She went there, crossed rivers, wearing big boots, and got into the homes of these people, helped them in their struggles, spoke to them, gave them, with her own courage, gave them a sense of great willingness to fight. She gave an example with her activity. Moreover, most of these companies had hired gunmen who literally existed to knock off anybody who dared to organize the miners. Sheriff deputies who were made deputies, even though they were criminal elements. But they couldn't intimidate Mother Jones. She would literally go in the jaws of death, so to speak. And by her own example, she gave the miners the courage to fight. And so they not only admired her, but they revered her because she was able to show them how to stand up and struggle.
What was her organizing style like?
Well, her organizing style was first to go where the miners were. Secondly, to live with them under terrible conditions. She lived with them, she got to know them, they got to know her. And then her organizing style was to make them ashamed of not organizing, to make them feel that they owed it to their children, to their wives, to bring about a better condition. Otherwise, their children would continue to live in the misery that they were experiencing. So she gave them a sense of shame and a hope for the future. In addition to which, she was able to involve the women of the miners. Very important in this, because in Pennsylvania, for example, many of the strikes that she led in Pennsylvania were conducted by the wives of the miners. The miners themselves were put in jail by the companies and the Pennsylvania Cossacks, who were the coal and iron police. And so she took the miners' wives and got them to conduct the struggle while their husbands were in jail with their pots and their pans and militancy, which just astounded the nation. This was her strategy. She was able to involve not just the miners themselves, but the whole family in the struggle. This is one of her major contributions to the labor movement, that strategy of struggle. But there's no question that Mother Jones was feared by the employers because they knew when she came into the area, things would begin to happen, and they did. And she was fearless, literally. For example, she went to jail many times. In West Virginia, she was in jail for almost 2 years, and under martial law. The military just put her in jail without any charges or anything to get out of the way. So she was kept in a dungeon. She called it the Bastille. And yet she was able, guarded by militiamen, the National Guard, but she was able to convert the militiamen. They would speak to her. And so she got messages out of the jail. For example, there were reports in the Senate that she was being kept in jail. And this message came to the United States Senate, and a senator read it from her, And it started a whole senatorial investigation of the strike. She was a master publicist when it came to knowing how to arouse attention. And all of these letters and speeches and given during the strikes are in this book. And then in Colorado, she was also in jail during this great strike that led to the Ludlow Massacre in 1914. She was constantly in danger of being picked up. In fact, when she traveled on a train, very often the conductor would come back and say, "Mother Jones, they're waiting for you at the next station." And then they would hide her in the freight car and put baggage on top of her, and they'd come and they couldn't find her, and then she'd get by. And workers always knew where she was and helped her in every one of them, because they knew she was working for their cause. So there's no question that Mother Jones was one of the most remarkable figures in the labor movement, because she went on her own, but she was always bringing people into action, into motion.
What are some of the conditions that she wanted the mine workers to work for?
Well, first, she wanted to put an end to this whole company town business, which means that the miners were dominated from birth to death by the company. Everything was controlled by the company. She fought against that and played a very big role in the final ending of this system. Then she was very active in the fight to end gunmen. Now, this was one of the things she particularly was so strong on. You have no idea. At that time, all these companies hired gunmen. And anybody who dared to speak out for a union or for against any conditions was really in danger of being killed, because nobody questioned the power of these companies. So the fight against company gunmen is one of the great fights that Mother Jones waged. And she gave the workers the courage to fight these gunmen. For example, there's a fabulous story of the time when she came into one of these strikes in West Virginia, and the company gunmen were sent out notice. They had machine guns that anybody who dared to come into this area would be shot right away. So she came in, and she walked up to the gunman and the machine gun and said, "Look, if you dare to shoot, I have 10,000 miners within 2 miles with guns, with Winchesters, and they'll just wipe you out, and you'll never get any news of what's been happening to you." Well, they picked up their guns and left. Of course, there were no miners armed in the area, but she was able to do that. But so, and then she, one of the things she fought very strongly again was the use of the children as breaker boys. At that time in the mines, young children, and I mean young, from 6 to 7, would be working as breaker boys, where they would be screening the coal to make sure that the correct size and other things came through the screening. And instead of going to school or having any other type of decent life, they spent their lives as young people in the mines or around the mines. And she fought that. And another thing was, you see, many states, including Pennsylvania, had laws that you were not supposed to use boys or children in the mines or in other industries under the age of 12. But, of course, the laws were meaningless, because they permitted the parents to sign a statement to the effect that the child was 15 or 16. And these people were so poor, they depended so much on their children's wages, that they were forced literally to perjure themselves. But she fought that. And she tried to get laws passed, and did, to raise the way, to effectively enforce this. And in fact, one of her great contributions was the struggle against child labor. And that's particularly true in Philadelphia.
Yeah, do you want to describe the Children's March that she
does
from the city?
Yes, this is something which made her famous in Philadelphia history, although it doesn't always end up in the history books. In 1903, Philadelphia was a big industrial center, and one of the big industries in Philadelphia was the textile industry. There were, at that time, 600 textile mills in the Philadelphia area with 100,000 textile workers. That was how important Philadelphia was. Well, on May 23rd, 1903, these workers went on strike a very important strike. Now, of these 100,000 workers, there were about, among them, there were about 16,000 who were children working in the textile mills. When I mean children 6 years old. And what were they fighting for in the strike? They were fighting for a 55-hour week. Workers in the textile mills of Philadelphia in 1903 were working 60 hours a week, including the children were working 60 hours a week. The children were earning $2 a week for 60 hours. The adults were earning $13 a week, and they went on strike. At that time, the Socialist Party in Philadelphia, which was relatively strong and had as its secretary a fascinating person whom I've written about, Carolyn Hollingsworth Pemberton, of the very distinguished families in Philadelphia, was a socialist. And she appealed to Mother Jones, who was then in West Virginia, to come and help the strikers. And she came. And she right away put these children on display to show the people of Philadelphia what the conditions were like that these children were forced to work under. Well, she couldn't get the newspapers to report anything of this. And when she asked the reporters, they told her that the mill owners owned shares in the newspapers, and therefore the newspapers were afraid to publish anything about it. So she made a very interesting statement. She said in her statement at the time, well, they owned stock in the mill owners in the newspapers. She said, well, I've got stock in these little children, and I'll arrange a little publicity. And she did, and she organized a meeting in front of the city hall with William Penn looking down on it. And I put the little boys with their fingers off from the machinery and their hands crushed and maimed on a platform. I held up their mutilated hands and showed them to the crowd and made the statement that Philadelphia's mansions were built on the broken bones, the quivering hearts, and drooping heads of these little children. Well, that did get into the newspapers, but that wasn't enough. She decided to organize a march, taking these children from Independence Hall to see President Theodore Roosevelt, who was spending his summer in Oyster Bay, Long Island, and to get him to support a law in Congress to abolish child labor. And that started the march, a very famous march. It's called the March of the Mill Children. Several hundred Philadelphia mill children, boys and girls, with help, with the parents in some cases helping, went on this walk from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay. It took several weeks, and labor movement helped all along, and then finally came to Oyster Bay, where the Secret Service wouldn't let her go in to see the president because they were afraid of her as being too radical. And Roosevelt refused to see her. He was furious about it, that she was furious about it, and organized a campaign to have him not reelected. But at any rate, even though no law was passed in Congress, she did, because of the publicity connected with this march, bring about a real anti-child labor law in Pennsylvania, and then New Jersey and New York copied it. So she played an important role in the ending of child labor. She had worked in a textile mill in the South herself to find out what it was like, so she knew these conditions.
That's another example of why you call her an inspired publicist.
Oh, she was a master publicist. She knew how to bring attention to all these conditions.
She addressed some of the social conditions, social problems within the mining towns, like alcoholism. And
not only mining towns, everywhere.
And wife abuse as well. How did she address that? Was she for temperance?
Well, no, she was not for temperance. At the same time, she was not for excessive drinking. For example, when a strike started, she was very active in seeing to it that all the saloons were closed, etc. At the same time, she felt that under the conditions that existed, being able to go to a saloon, being able to drink, was a social experience for workers, which couldn't just be ignored. But at the same time, she tried to get them to exercise personal temperance. So, but she was against legal temperance. On wife abuse, she used the tactic of shame. She was very good at that. In her speeches, she always made the workers, male workers, feel ashamed of the way in which they treated their wives and their children. And they often, when she finished the speech, they would come up and take the pledge practically to change in these things. She was very good in inspiring workers, an excellent speaker. And she knew how to use the language of the street, too. Some of her speeches were non-reproducible because of this.
Let me quote something that she says in, I think it was one of her speeches or letters, but you quote her as saying that the rank and file have let the servants become their masters and dictators. The workers have to not only fight their exploiters, but their leaders as well, who often betray them, who sell them out, who put their own advancement ahead of the working masses, and who make of the rank and file political pawns. What was her objections to union leadership at the time she was organizing? We're talking about the first part of the 20th century.
Well, this was something which she saw and was not the only one to see. Others saw it. As the labor movement developed and became stronger, what had once been a very hazardous and difficult undertaking, namely to be a labor leader, meant almost taking your life in your hand, became quite different as the unions got stronger and they got treasuries and agreements were made between the employers and the leaders. Many of the outstanding leaders of big business tried to work an arrangement with the labor leaders whereby they would benefit from not being so militant, not being so radical, not being so active. And she saw this. She saw that in one of the first leaders of the United Mine Workers, John Mitchell, who was with whom she worked very closely. At one time, when she went into the feudal areas of West Virginia, into the back, he would go with her for going across the icy mountain streams into the back country. Later, he began to live a much better life. He began to have a big income. There's a report, for example, in one of the conventions of the United Mine Workers, which infuriated her. He lost a ring worth $100,000 in Atlantic City. Well, she was furious at that. And then he was very active in an organization which she hated, namely the National Civic Federation, where he and Gompers and other labor leaders would have dinners several times a year with J.P. Morgan, August Belmont, John D. Rockefeller, the outstanding leaders of big business. And she felt that that was betraying the workers because while they were dining, the miners were living on nothing, starving. And she was infuriated by this. And she attacked John Mitchell, and she resigned from the United Mine Workers over this. She joined the Western Federation of Miners and organized for them because that was a militant union. Later, she went back. But later, she became very anti-John L. Lewis because he, too, at that time, was a corrupt and dictatorial labor leader.
Did she have any reservations about criticizing the labor leaders? Because frequently in a situation like that, someone will feel that it's better to keep the ranks closed so that anyone who's your opposition can't benefit by your division.
Well, I agree with you. She didn't go around recklessly attacking leadership right and left, but she was very anxious to get the workers to see that these conditions should not be tolerated. And by resigning from the United Mine Workers, she publicized the fact that she couldn't take this leadership. For example, although she was not rich at all, she was poor towards the end because she gave most of her money back, she still had $1,000. She gave that to the campaign that was being waged by the rank and file against Lewis at that time because Lewis was very much of a, in the 20s, later he became a very different sort of person, very much in terms of a dictator and a seller out. He sold out the miners very often. On the other hand, she worked very closely with leaders who were honest and militant, John Fitzpatrick of the Chicago Federation of Labor, William Z. Foster in the steel strike of 1919. So she didn't attack all leaders. She simply said that there was a danger that labor leadership was becoming removed from the problems of the rank and file. In other words, her position was, that's why she never wanted a big salary. She felt once you begin to live on a high level, you lose sight of what the conditions of the workers are. And when you lose that, you make deals which betray the workers.
Did the labor leaders criticize her as she began to criticize them?
That's one of the reasons, for example, why she was not popular for a long time. For example, when her autobiography was published, they didn't do much to push it because in there she exposed many of these leaders.
Would you consider Mother Jones a feminist?
No, I would not. In fact, the feminists, there are feminists who don't like Mother Jones. Sometimes I think I've had my differences with some of the feminists on this. For example, some feminists feel that she doesn't belong really in the history of the women's movement because she spent so much of her time organizing men, as if the conditions that men have shouldn't be changed. But that happens to be not true. She, even among the miners, she played a very important role in involving the women, and she was loved by the wives and daughters of the miners. And also, she helped the needle trades workers. They always called upon her. She always helped the women in their activities. But she did have certain... She was, for example, not friendly to some of the movements of the women's group, like the Women's Trade Union League, which was helping women organize. She was not too friendly to them because upper-class women were involved in it. Now, I had no objection to that because these upper-class women were making a very important contribution. But Mother Jones tended to feel that these upper-class women coming in from the upper class would tend to hold back the militancy of the movement. Later, she changed her mind on that. And then, of course, a major difference between her and the feminists was that she was ambivalent on the question of women's suffrage. She would make statements of saying, I don't need the vote. I raise hell. And if the women would spend more time organizing economically instead of fighting for the vote, they would be better off in changing their conditions. On the other hand, she would make statements saying that when women get the vote, they'll change things and make things better and help the struggle against war. So her ambivalence on this antagonized the feminist elements. And it's still... something which is strong among certain groups of feminists.
What was her standing in the American Socialist Party?
Well, she probably was the most famous American socialist among women. I mean, the Appeal to Reason, which was the leading socialist paper, published a series of pictures of socialist women, and the leading place was occupied by Mother Jones. Eugene Victor Debs, who loved her and with whom she worked closely, felt that there was no one like Mother Jones. She was in a class by herself. At the same time, it's very interesting. She had the same feeling about certain elements in the Socialist Party that she did about elements in the labor movement. She felt that the Socialist Party was being taken over by right-wing elements. She had no respect for lawyers like Morris Hillquit, politicians like Victor Berger, and others whom she felt were keeping the Socialist Party from becoming a real revolutionary party. So she was critical of that, and she had differences with them. Mother Jones is not a very consistent person. But then consistency isn't the only thing that counts. One could fault her for some of her views, but I will say this, that with a few exceptions, there are very few people in American labor history who have been so consistently class conscious and class involved in trying to improve the conditions of the workers personally under very difficult conditions as Mother Jones.
She organized until she was in her 90s. Why did she stop when she did? I know I shouldn't be asking how she stopped sooner, but...
First of all, she was very sick. She had arthritis. She could, in fact, one of the problems of publishing her letters toward the end was that it was very difficult for her to write. it's almost impossible at times to make out her handwriting. She suffered very severely from arthritis and rheumatism. And, at the her last major speech was delivered in 1923, at the age of 93, at a Farmer Labor Party convention in Chicago. Well, I think you'll have to admit that that's active pretty late in life. This didn't mean that she gave up the activity altogether. As late as 1931, for example, not 1930, during the Great Depression, she sent a memo to President Hoover demanding that the government provide public works for the unemployed as a way of alleviating the conditions. So she was alert to the very end.
My guest is Philip Foner, and he's a labor historian who has just edited a collection of Mother Jones's speeches, writings, letters. It's called Mother Jones Speaks, and it's published by the Monad Press. The title, again, is Mother Jones Speaks. Philip Foner is a labor historian who has also written extensively on Afro-American history, women's history, and the history of socialism. And he just returned from about it was 5 or 6 months in China, where he lectured to 10 different universities on the subject of American history. Is there a lot of interest now in China about American history?
Oh, yes. there is quite a interesting exchange between Chinese students of American history who are coming to the United States to study at American universities, including Temple, University of Pennsylvania, many universities, and American professors who are going to China. There they're called foreign experts, teaching different aspects of American history. The Chinese are very interested in the American background, American experience, and they are trying very hard to learn many, many aspects of it. And labor history, being a socialist country, naturally, American labor history is a very important subject with them. So I gave many lectures on American labor history, which, by the way, have been published in Chinese, and 2 million copies distributed all over the country, and also on black history and on current problems and on women's history, and in quite a few universities. This is my second visit, and I would say that one thing that impressed me was that they're making a good deal of progress compared to the situation 2 years before when I went in 1981. They have more books now. Their students are more acquainted with important aspects of American history. When I first went there, they were still trying to recover from the terrible effects of the Cultural Revolution, which had literally closed down the universities, had prevented any new studies, any new work being done, and no new books were obtained, and they were really very, very behind the times. So they were trying desperately to catch up. They've begun to do that in a very significant way, and they're very anxious to continue, hardworking, and I think that they're going to make an important contribution.
Is there any interest in American popular culture there now, in movies, music?
Music, yes, yes. Movies, yes, but of course they don't get too many American movies. I will say this, that the interest in movies among young people in China is very, very strong. And it doesn't necessarily have to be. They make their own movies, by the way. The Chinese have quite a big film industry, and then they also have movies from Hong Kong. I saw two interesting films there, which I hope they show here, because they're dubbed, they're already with English subtitles. They deal with the period of the last emperors and the particularly the occupation of China after the Boxer Rebellion, when the various imperialist countries, including the United States, moved in and occupied large sections of China. United States didn't occupy, but they worked with the British on this. So there's the French settlement and the Russian settlement and the German settlement and the English, etc. And they show all that and how China was literally brought to its knees and colonized by the foreigners. And then the second film deals with the Empress Dowager. That was when the emperor died, the young emperor was 8 years old, was ruled by his mother and the Empress Dowager, who was the concubine of the emperor, and how she maneuvered everything is very well done. It's an excellent film.
Do you speak
the two of them?
Do you speak any Chinese now?
Little, but it's not an easy language to master. I use interpreters in my lectures, and they have many to provide. And then there are more and more Chinese who are studying English. It's very difficult to jog in China in the morning without having a young, someone young coming jogging next to you and saying, do you mind if we speak English while we jog so they can practice their English while you're running next to each other? And sometimes you end up with three or four running with you in order to practice their English.
Great. I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your trip and about your new collection of Mother Jones's writing. It's great to see you again.
Fine.
Thanks for being
Thanks
here.
Thanks a lot, and I look forward to seeing you again.